begin at halftime. It's that time when you get to the unforgiving and to enact critical vengeance on the chorus. So remind me to do that at halftime. Rebecca Comey, in her unpublished account of Hegel, says that despite its conventional, even banal appearance, banal appearance, Hegelian forgiveness is, when scratched, as hyperbolic or as impossible as anything in Derrida. It is as asymmetrical as anything in Levinas, as paradoxical as anything in Kierkegaard. It opens onto a future as natal, as interruptive in its novelty as anything in Arendt, and onto a past as obdurate as anything in Kristeva. Hegel's account anticipates and displaces the Nietzschean analysis of ascetic economy of debt and credit, together with its Bataille variations. Now, the crux of this, which we will not get to till next week, occurs in absolute knowing. Absolute knowing is, I'm going to argue, the standpoint of forgiveness, which we have been inhabiting all along. So, what I have to say about forgiveness today will anticipate, but not fully pick up, what we'll have to say about it next week. And when I do talk about it next week, I will be making reference to the account of forgiveness in Kristeva's Black Sun, in particular the chapter on Dostoevsky, suffering, and forgiveness. So it's just some hand waving. We ended last time by discovering that there was a reason for the hard heart and the refusal to return the confession, namely that no one is entitled to or deserves forgiveness or recognition. And that is because recognition, or so I'm arguing, is the condition of possibility of any entitlement one may have, and therefore nothing can condition it. Recognition is the foundation, and everything else follows from it. Recognition is therefore not something you can earn or deserve. It is the possibility of anyone earning or deserving anything whatsoever. So what the hard heart unintentionally revealed by the refusal of communication is that recognition is never directly symmetrical. There never is reciprocal recognition. Recognition is something that always happens too early or too late. There is always a symmetry. And that is because the moment of confession reveals what is a moment of absolute dependence. that very issue we've been getting at since the master-slave, the logic of independence and dependence. There's no outside to that, that, and here we're coming to what I suggested again when we did the master and slave, that we are both absolutely independent of every other, I'll come to what that means in a moment, and absolutely or unconditionally dependent. And the humiliation, the abasement, the discovery of impotence and powerlessness that the confessing one, the one who confesses evil, discovers is that dependence, that her capacity to have a world and to be herself is not up to her, but depends and depends absolutely on another. And if that other turns away, then there is nothing to be done. What she is rebuffed by is the silence of judging consciousness, and that silence is a willful indifference. It is always indifference, coldness, the coldness of traditional reason, the coldness of the reigning universal, that we discover outside ourselves. Or, to put it another way, Hegel thinks that the hard-heartedness of judging consciousness is the truth about traditional universality. That traditional universality, its distance from us, its implacability, its apparent overarchingness, is nothing but the assertion of a will. But a will that's turning away rather than to us. So when we say of the universal that it is indifferent to human meaning and human needs, we are simply saying that it is hard-hearted. The truth of universality is that it was always that, a refusal of communication. The hard heart, the beautiful soul, withdraws into itself. But in turning in on itself, what can happen? Well, Hegel says that what happens is madness, which, on the face of it, may sound overly optimistic. I mean, after all, suggesting that something happens. Well, I'm not sure I have a precise analogy, but at least the one I'd like to try is thinking a little bit about King Lear. That is, I want to think of Lear as someone who is a propounding of hardness of heart. The situation of Lear, as I read it, is that his intention is to move from being a king, or let's call it a deity, a god, to becoming an ordinary mortal, a natural man, an unaccommodated man. That's why he's dividing his kingdom. He wants to, in his dotage, become a man and stop being a god. Which is to say that King Lear, at least as I understand it, is about the movement from an enchanted metaphysical universe, where there are such things as gods and deities, to a disenchanted universe, which is made up of only natural beings. It is for this reason, on my reading of it at least, that's the meaning of the storm. The storm is about the decreation of the natural world. It's about the discovery of the natural world as chaos and not divine order, so that as Lear collapses into madness, the mirroring of that in the natural world is not accidental. That is, Bloom is wrong. It's not a cosmological event. It's a cultural event. It's the event it's the same event as Hobbes's discovery of the natural world, namely the world is no longer a place of order, but of disorder that we have to arise out of. All that, since I just made it up, is controversial, but we'll let that go. It's not implausible. Unplausible?
It's fine.
Fine, good. Yeah, good, thank you. So, the thought about Lear, then, is the following. That he rebuffs Cordelia because he does not want a sincere confession. What he wants is formality. What he wishes is nothing but hyperbole. And the reason that he does not want a sincere confession is because he does not want to be seen, because if he were seen, he would have to acknowledge his finitude, his mortality, his dependence. And that is what, I take it, he finds impossible and intolerable. And in fact, on my reading of the play, he finds it impossible and intolerable right to the end, that he never manages the transition from God to man, and remains hard-hearted. So he does not want the sincere confession that Cordelia offers him and demands of him, because then he would be seen as somehow not just loving her, but depending on that love for who he is, which is, of course, the truth of the play and what Lear finds intolerable. That is, what is intolerable is his actual love of her and her love of him. And therefore, all he can do, since it's intolerable, since it's an absolute dependence that is intolerable, is turn away. He goes mad. That is, there is no further step one can make. If you turn away from the conditions of existence, and I'm claiming that's what is at stake here, the conditions of existence for a being, then you cut yourself off from the grounds of possibility of anything whatsoever. So that his driving into madness and wilderness and chaos is all that is left to him, and nothing else. We might say that madness truly is the cost of remaining a god or a beautiful soul. So although Hegel is, of course, thinking about Hölderlin and Novalis, there's nothing about tracking them that's, I think, particularly helpful in the reference to madness. But I find the tracking of the Lear story at least the beginning of an account about what madness means in modernity. That is, how madness is see that
God looks here.
Philosophy is always trying to de-psychologize psychology. That is, to show, right? This is, by the way, this is how I read Freud, so this would be another course, but that is to show that what look like merely psychological events are categorical events that are structural for the very constitution of the human. That's what I mean by de-psychologizing psychology. We don't want to get rid of psychological categories. On the contrary, what we want to do is raise them up so that they have the weight of the category. And I'm suggesting that madness is a certain type of category because it is tied to a certain refusal of a condition of possibility of human existence. So it belongs to the structural features of what it is to be a self-conscious agent. So the beautiful soul, Hegel says, and now this is paragraph 668, he says, the beautiful soul lacking an actual existence. That's the claim.
That's the claim I just made.
And what the beautiful soul lacks is any mode of actuality. Ergo, madness as the being of the suppression of the conditions of existence, of actuality, entangled in the contradiction between its pure self and the necessity of that self to externalize itself. And that's what he's trying to reveal here, the necessity. So in order for us to feel the weight of this, what we have to feel is that Lear, say, is turning away from the necessary conditions for him to exist as an actual individual. For that, he would have to externalize himself. That is, not escape the discourse of flattery, escape the discourse of pure, empty ritual, and enter into what I'm calling, for want of a better word, communication. Caught in the contradiction between pure self and the necessity of that self to externalize itself and change itself into an actual existence. So actual existence is something that can be, and actuality is a very difficult word in Hegel's logic, actuality is something that can be had or lost. That is not the same as mere facticity in Hegel. Actuality is, let's call it, the realization of an essence. Berkeley. So what's being asked of judging consciousness is that it change itself, convert, turn around, become. There's no logic here, because nothing's going to tell it what to do. That is, the very thing that's required of it is something that can only be known in the sense of having any reflective grasp of it, as it were, after it's been completed. Which is why we watch Lear with such horror. It's a train wreck. And he never does the turn. Right? All of it's there waiting for him. In every moment, redemption is possible. And neither he nor Gloucester ever manage it. Nor for that matter does Edgar. Edgar too. You might say that Lear is nothing but a study of various forms of hard-heartedness, locked inwardness, what a Kleinian would call the schizoid position. right? Because each of them are refusals of finitude, of their conditionality, and each of them suffer from various forms of shame. Should be another. So the refusal to change, where the word change, I guess I'm saying here, has all the weight of a religious conversion. That's what I'm trying to get. The notion of being asked to change is the phrase, you must change your life. That's the notion of change here. And that, I take it, is an existential event, not a conceptual event. Because of that, and dwelling, Hegel goes on to say, in the immediacy of this firmly held antithesis. So what's the madness? The madness is the purity on the one hand and the demand for change, actualization on the other. So it's literally a contradiction. Right? You have to see in the beautiful soul an absolute existential contradiction in the flesh. An immediacy which alone, the immediacy, Hegel says here, is the middle term, reconciling the antithesis, which is to say, it's unreconciled, which has been intensified to its pure abstraction and is pure being or empty nothingness. Because now there's only this. I mean, there's only this. The choice of either holding on to that purity or externalizing it, and there's no other places for this positionality to go, then there's no mediation between those two forms of what? What are those two forms of? Absolute independence. That's the beautiful soul itself. And absolute dependence. The externalization. Those two things at this moment are absolutely joined without mediation. Hence, when you leave them unresolved, unmediated, what you have here is nothingness. Not a determinate negation, but nothingness itself. This beautiful soul, Hegel goes on to say, then being conscious of this contradiction in its unreconciled immediacy, is disordered to the point of madness, wastes itself in yearning, and pines away in consumption. Got all the illnesses possible for a 19th century intellectual. Madness, consumption, yearning, the whole thing. He just threw in the whole kitchen sink there. The point I want to underline then is that the insistence on its purity, on perfection, becomes the most radical act of willfulness. It is nothing but a willfulness, and therefore becomes pure evil. So we get this extraordinary reversal of positions here at every level, right? We started out with the acting consciousness who was willful and evil, right? Finally discovering, right, the unavoidability of evil, the continuum hypothesis, and in discovering the unavoidability of evil, that is, the unavoidability of transgressing upon our existing shared forms of interaction as a condition for significant action, discovering that evil, therefore, is nothing more than the spontaneity of action, the necessity of singularity for the existence of any possible universal, the unavoidability of transgression under conditions of significant action, that you always have to break the existing law to institute new law, new norms, and hence the discovery that its natural passions and self is equally a necessary condition for action. All these discoveries by what I'm calling the new Antigone is what leads her to confess. And in confessing, right, to try to generate a new universality between herself and her other, because she recognizes that both of them, right, are in the same position, that they're both individuals insisting upon universality, and the difference between acting and judging is literally perspectival, not absolute. So the confessing, acting consciousness enters into the place of universality, while judging consciousness, precisely in its attempt to sustain its position of universality, in insisting upon that universality, reveals that behind the universality is nothing but an individual will, and hence in insisting on it becomes willful, singular, and evil. So that the whole movement between acting and confession consciousness is about a reversal of their inaugural positions. So Hegel now has to, since the origin judging consciousness, beautiful soul, has faded away, pined away in consumption, has to imagine a new such individual. And roughly, his thought here is this. What can I do? What can anyone do with the hurt that has been done to me? Assume that each of us at some point are in the position of being the injured party. What can we do with human injury, with harm? How can we respond to it? Ultimately, Hegel wants to claim that there are only two fundamental possibilities. First, I can hurt you in return. Which is to say that revenge is the natural, mechanical, and spontaneous logic of response to harm. It is the logic of, for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Hence, for Hegel,
yes indeed,
thank you.
So for Hegel, revenge is the type, the form of all non-spiritual response to injury. I am, in being vengeful, I am acting out of my hurt. I am nursing that hurt. I am holding on to my hurt, and I will not let it go for anything. I take that injury and harm to be who I am, and therefore it is my past, and I am that past, and I will act on that past and nothing else. So vengeance is taking a bit of the past and making it determinant for any possible future. And in making the past determinant for any possible future, I am making sure that there is no future. It is only the repetition of that past. Therefore, vengeance is a form of determination, of even determinism. It is anti-historical, because it operates on, I'm suggesting, something like a natural law, for every action equals spontaneous reaction, and therefore wholly unfree. As far as I can make out, the logic of melancholia and the logic of revenge are identical. That vengeance is the melancholia of ethical life. Which is why, when we see it acted out, which is what we're seeing all over in all these ethnic debates and religious debates at the moment, it is so horrifying. It is so horrifying because clearly we are watching a machine. And we realize there's nothing in the logic of that machine to stop it. So we are right to be horrified, right to sense our powerlessness, right to sense that this is a form of doom. Hegel suggests there's another alternative. Say, I forgive you. What has been done, what has been made, can in some sense be unmade, undone. Or at least made as if it had not been done. And Hegel, that is, we can change the past. Or at least take the past as not an ultimate set of facts and determinations, but as something open to spiritual transformation. No act, therefore, could be more spiritual. That is, if there's an act that takes us out of nature, if according to the laws of nature, what's happened has happened and it's finished. So we may say the determinacy of the past is the truth of nature without spirit. This makes forgiveness, the transformation, the unmaking of the past, the supreme
spiritual act. The overcoming of nature, not by laws, but in its deepest metaphysical set of assumptions, namely the pastness of the past. Spirit can undo the undoable. We are, Hegel thinks, the kinds of beings who can reverse or at least change the past, and that spirit, and that is what spirit is. And in discovering that it can do this, spirit is, I'm going to claim, unbounded from within. If even the past is not out of its reach, then nothing is. Forgiveness, when it comes not because the other deserves it, but simply from an act of recognition. Or rather, forgiveness is the act of recognition. The recognition that either we have a life together or there is no life at all. There's just the machine of the past. In vengeance, you nurse your hurt, and that is what judging consciousness does. Judging consciousness is locked in its injury, and then, of course, there is nowhere to go. In releasing the other from their misdeed, you also release yourself from your entrapment in injury. That is, you can only escape your sense of injury, the harm that's been done to you. Maybe a horrific harm done to you. If you are to have a future, you have to release the other.
That is.
Okay. Yep.
So a question about why this has to come to the text according to the logic of it. If you say something terrible was done to you and you desire vengeance but didn't act on it, but it somehow still kind of rankled with you.
That will be enough, right? Vengeance doesn't have to be that, right?
But does forgiveness somehow have to be actualized? Because say you do something terrible for me and I find a way of going on, which doesn't seem to determine me, can I live a life that when I've kind of forgiven you internally, if you see what I mean, in the same way that vengeance can remain internal and still determine, can you forgive without it becoming actualized into subjective?
Depends where the other person is. If they're, say, sharing your bed, the point is you may not say the words, but either your attitude, right? It's a matter of attitude about whether there's going to be a new beginning or not, whether you're going to hold that past against the other, demand that they be responsible for it, and not let them off. That is, you tie them to that past, and in tying them to that past, you tie yourself to it, right? Or you don't. Right? So that the point about the performativity of forgiveness is simply to make clear it is not a logical move, it's not a move in conceptual space, it's a move in existential space, namely it is attorney.
Oh,
there's
a little
hatch
there,
yeah.
You
know this.
I was thinking back to say, very beginning with this British Christianity,
mm-hmm.
and the kind of criminal.
Yeah.
Right. To raise the same question for that kind of issue, would, I mean, the internalized given without performativity would be a way to say of the community finding a way of going on which continues to exclude them if they happen publicly. But it's at least possible that from the community's point of view, there's no reason to let the criminal back in if you can find a way of going on.
And I'm saying you'll never find a way of going on.
Right. Okay.
That they're being imprisoned or exiled or whatever you've done, you've got to keep the prison going, you've got to keep the walls up, not let them in, ostracism is ostracism, and then you are determined by that determination. So yeah, we're not going to let them determine our past, no way, you know, you can just hear the anger. We're going to go on to spite them. Yeah. No. So I really want to claim it's impossible.
Is it ever possible then to really leave no scars behind?
I'll come to that. I know what that means. Yeah.
Just an analytical question. Retribution and vengeance then are not really all that different.
Right.
So any question of justice is then actually a mislocated, it's a category.
I'll come to that in a second as well. No, I have to say something about, because Hegel blatantly defends a retributive theory of justice, right? So we need to ask about that.
Can I follow up on the point about the performance of it? It's hard for me to imagine what an existential turn would be that didn't at some point tend toward
performance of some kind.
Toward history, which requires to me a deed.
Right. Of course, and the deed not be saying, I forgive you, and maybe come to dinner tonight.
Right.
Or money, shall we go to bed at the same time tonight? In the same room. I mean, no, but those are, I'm claiming those are statements of forgiveness, right?
But in that case, forgiveness can also fail.
Of course it can fail. Of course it can fail. Because it's attitudinal, and you can't just say the words, and we've learned why performativity is so difficult, because it has a potential for sheer emptiness. Right? So if you've been taught, that was the whole point about the logic of flattery, the very nature of performativity doesn't guarantee the existential transformation. So of course, especially if I'm a good Christian, I say, of course I forgive you. That's why we know that those pious Christians hate us, right? And every time they forgive us, they hate us even more. And it's so that rituality won't do. The performativity here is a statement about what is not logical or conceptual or inferential, but it doesn't, and it's meant to capture something that has an existential character, but is not a mere performance. Right? For all the reasons we learned about performativity, how difficult it is, how easily it can misfire, how it can be the most hollow thing, right? Which is part of Hegel's point. What is going to save us, if anything can, is rest on that contingent basis. It's not the security of a logical inference. It's the difficulty of performance and all that entails. Which means, always, even for myself, the threat of hollowness. I hear myself saying the words, and even in saying them, know I don't fully believe them. And don't know what I can do. Right? Except go back to my therapist. Okay, so let me press on and do a few more twists and turns and see if some of these questions can hang out, and then we can see if we can carry on with the discussion. So Arendt says, in the human condition, in contrast to revenge,
which is the natural automatic reaction to transgression, and which, because of the irreversibility of the action process, can be expected and even calculated, the act of forgiving can never be predicted. It is the only reaction that acts in an unexpected way, and thus retains, though being a reaction, something of the original character of action. Forgiving, in other words, is the only reaction which does not merely react, but acts anew and unexpectedly, unconditioned by the act which provoked it, and therefore freeing from its consequences both the one who forgives and the one who is forgiven. Action for Arendt means beginning something new. Hence the notion of her notion of natality that is supposed to be the marker of action. So what she, and the reason she uses natality, and in this Hegel should be very happy, is, and the reason why she didn't want to use the language of freedom, right, and spontaneity, is because she wanted to make clear that the states were existential and social and not metaphysical and cosmological. That is, she thinks that the whole freedom determinism debate is a mistake. Right? Very much like the Wittgensteinian. She just thinks there is no such problem, that the whole truth about action and freedom belongs within the social and has no external or cosmological meaning, none that we could ever find our way through. Hence she uses the notion of natality rather than freedom to mark out what matters about human freedom, namely beginning anew, which of course is equally what matters for Hegel. Right? He does say right at the beginning of the book, we live in a birth time, and he's about trying to uncover the conditions for us being truly natal rather than truly, let's call it traditional, metaphysical. Why then is recognition the ultimate moment here? Why does Hegel mark this moment as the completion of spirit? It has to do with absolute otherness. We know from the very beginning of the course that something about the whole project has to do with self-recognition in absolute otherness. And we know that phrase, self-recognition in absolute otherness, is the one that drives anti-Hegelians crazy, right? Because they see that as the great Hegelian monster reducing everything that's different to the same. That very phrase sounds like, to anti-Hegelians, a flag for the reduction of all otherness. Well, Hegel thinks that we are at that moment when we will have discovered, assuming everything that's gone before, the one thing that is truly and absolutely other to me. Another is freedom. The one thing I can never determine, the one thing that I can never, as it were, fully touch, the one thing that is always infinitely separate from me, is the freedom, spontaneity of another human being. and it's in virtue of their freedom
that they are absolutely other. So the otherness for Hegel is always the otherness of another human being, and it's the otherness of another human being because of their spontaneity. And not just the fact of their spontaneity, but the fact that I am absolutely dependent on that spontaneity for my existence überhaupt. That my very being depends on what I can never take possession of. So the discovery, so what recognition is that act of spontaneity which lets another be. And without which they cannot be, and which if I do not do, I cannot be. Which is to say that involved here are two irreducible spontaneities, two irreducible powers of negativity. So this act of forgiveness is a perfectly spiritual act, because it is premised on nothing but spontaneity itself and nothing else. That is, it's a groundless act. It is the deed from which all else follows. In the beginning was the deed. The deed is one of recognition, and vice versa, being recognized. Now, this is equally a reversal of the natural order of things, right? Beginning in spontaneity and not in causality. And it is our power over the past. If time is real, that is, if, and I take it time is real, then even if God existed and had complete foreknowledge of what would happen, he too would have to wait for a deed to occur. Even God is determined by time, if there was a God. Spirit is more powerful than God, because spirit can undo that very past that God had to wait upon. Well, first question, can we really reverse time? Isn't forgiveness, like confession itself, an irreducibly theological concept? Those are such good questions. I think we'll have a break there. And I will hand out these student evaluation forms. Roxy, can you bring these to the dean tomorrow?
Sure.
So if you, when you're done, hand them in to Roxy, and we'll start again in a little while.